Vancouver, that is, beat the Blackhawks 4-1. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. Rain until late this afternoon. Then it'll turn into a windy and snowy day, up to 2 inches for Racine and Kenosha, 2 to 3 inches in Walworth County, with winds up to 35 miles per hour. Walworth County is also under a winter weather advisory from 1 o'clock this afternoon until 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. Tonight, then, light snow and high winds continue. Look for an additional 1 to 2 inches of snow overnight. Total accumulation, 1 to 4 inches for Racine and Kenosha, 3 to 5 inches in Walworth County. Tonight's low 22. Tomorrow, a break. Cloudy for the morning, partly sunny for the afternoon. Tomorrow's high 28. Right now, some scattered drizzle, an overcast sky, 46 degrees, both are seen in Kenosha, 43 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. WGTD News time, 8 11. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. WGTD is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Our topic is a really important one today. Actually, there are a couple of different important topics. One of them is Parkinson's disease and the way in which it really dramatically alters one's life. And we're going to talk about all the ways in which one can go on living with Parkinson's and do all kinds of amazing things. And this is also going to be a conversation about the importance of telling one's own story, whatever that story might be, but particularly if one's story includes a debilitating illness like Parkinson's disease. My guest on the morning show, one of my two guests, is living with Parkinson's disease. Her name is Dr. Jenny Nelson, and she is an associate professor at the School of Media Arts and Studies at Ohio University in Athens, Ohio, a media scholar and founder of the Parkinson's Disease Narrative Project, Dr. Nelson was diagnosed with Parkinson's back in 2010, and she is doing more than just contending with it as an individual. She is also anxious to gather the stories of others who are living with Parkinson's, and just in the act of telling their own stories hopes to make a very powerful difference for the better in their lives. And also with us in the studios today is Camilo Perez, who is a doctoral student at Ohio University in the School of Media Arts. And his doctoral thesis, I believe, is this very same Parkinson's disease narrative project. The two of them are going to be speaking at the University of Wisconsin Parkside at 11 o'clock today, a special multimedia presentation which is open to the public, occurring in Molinaro Hall 105. But now they are with us in the studios to talk about this project, to talk about Parkinson's disease, and about the importance of sharing one's story and the possibility of doing that in the form of video storytelling, which is what this project is all about. Dr. Jenny Nelson and Camilo Perez, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you.
Good to have both of you here. I want to mention also that Professor Faye Akindis, who has been on the morning show before, a professor at UW Parkside, is responsible for arranging this conversation. She's quietly in the background snapping pictures and not going on the air today by her own choice, but I appreciate Professor Akindis making this this possible. Dr. Nelson, let's talk for a few minutes about something that has nothing to do with Parkinson's in and of itself. Let's talk just for a couple of minutes about the research which you have done for a long, long time and to some extent continue to do, primarily involving television viewing. Tell us, first of all, how you got interested in this as a serious researcher and scholar.
Well, I've been teaching in the areas of media analysis and criticism for a number of years, and especially interested in the different ways that people interpret different television shows. People bring their own, you know, history with them when they watch TV, so any two people could watch the same television show, and in their interpretation of it would be two completely different story. So I was always interested in, you know, how people sort of negotiated the watching of television. When I was diagnosed with the Parkinson's in 2010, I had a colleague who I shared this information with. Her name is Karen Sandell, and she had been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis about 18 years before and had been living with that. And when we would get together for lunch or whatever, we would talk about how, you know, whatever show we had watched about Parkinson's or multiple sclerosis, and, you know, it was a talk show or whatever. And we were always just a little uncomfortable with the way in which the interviews were carried out or the way in which it was, you know, sort of represented. And we decided that instead of just sitting around and bitching about it, that we might want to do something about it. So we applied for an 1804 grant at Ohio University to, again, sort of systematically analyze everything we could find on either in TV or film or books or in medical discourse. You know, what were some sort of the common themes that confronted people who would read or watch, you know, this material. And again, we found it lacking. So we sort of came to a point in our research where we sort of analyzed pretty much everything we could find, and we thought, well, so the project has, you know, pretty much come to an end. And at that point, we met Camilo here, who was had a lot of experience in video production, and our project took a turn towards production and actually talking with people who had Parkinson's. Even though I had done some interviews with some people that I had found in Parkinson's support groups in the area of southeastern Ohio and also in West Virginia. So I had begun to do a sort of an ethnography of people, but that was just with standard, you know, oral interviews and collecting them and transcribing them. And it was also in that moment of transcription when I was sort of taking the voices of these people and putting them on paper that I thought that this is not, it didn't feel right to sort of disembody, because their stories were so compelling that to sort of deaden them on paper for an academic article, it just felt like it was the wrong way to go.
Mm. We were missing something by not having their face and not having their voice,
right,
I suppose.
Right, exactly.
What
exactly.
did you mean earlier when you said in this research that you had done that you found it lacking? Did you mean that there was actually very little of the story of Parkinson's out there, or that what was out there was somehow shallow or misguided or full of misinformation, or maybe you mean both, or maybe you mean neither?
Well, I think the way it's sort of framed as a tragedy, you know, and in some sense, you know, that is, but if you look at the shows. There's an episode of House MD, for example, where a woman is diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, and she says, "I'd rather have cancer." Mm. You know, and then the story just left there. So a lot of times, Parkinson's is used for dramatic effect as sort of like the worst possible thing that could happen to anyone.
Mm.
So in any kind of script, right, when that comes up, it's like, "Oh, Parkinson's." And then it's like, "Oh, tragedy, tragedy." And then they go off with their main story with their characters, and it's just sort of left hanging there as this, you know, deadly disease with no more information about either how people cope with it or not. And so you get things. There's a film called Love and Other Drugs that has Anne Hathaway in it, and again, it seems it focuses on her, you know, her shaking hands, and then, you know, she's in the meds, and she's involved with a salesman, and blah, 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 blah. And again, that one was left with this, you know, this sense of Parkinson's is the worst thing that can happen to you, and again, the story doesn't go anywhere. It's just used for shock effect, and that seems to be the sort of the rhetorical trope that Parkinson's serves on in most media.
So it sounds like one of your hopes is by giving voice to a number of people, a wide variety of people contending with Parkinson's, that the story collectively will be enriched and one that isn't just kind of a dark kind of tragic story.
Right. So the for example, if we want to stick with television, Michael J. Fox has done an extremely excellent job in portraying Parkinson's as something that you live with. So he's been on talk shows, he's written, you know, two memoirs, he had his own show for a while, he's guest starred on, he's got a recurring role as a nefarious lawyer, Lewis Canning on The Good Wife, also in Curb Your Enthusiasm, in Dennis Leary's show, which was about the firefighters, I can't remember the name of it. But every time he's been a character on a show, it is pretty much of a guy struggling with the disease to some degree, but there's always something else about his personality or his character that isn't just Parkinson's.
Hmm.
You know,
this is such such interesting coincidence. Tomorrow's morning show is with an author by the name of Lissa Warren, and her book is mostly about, believe it or not, a lovely little cat that her family purchases, and what a huge difference this little cat makes in the life of their family, and in particularly her late father. But at the very end of the book, she, kind of out of the blue, as I suppose it usually happens, receives a diagnosis of MS.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things she talks about in that chapter is how anxious she is for people not to see her as MS. I mean, MS is not all that I am. And that's almost exactly what you just said in terms of when someone has Parkinson's disease, that isn't suddenly all that they are. It does not need to envelop their whole sense of identity, and they shouldn't be viewed as just someone with Parkinson's.
Right, and so it's not just even that designation, but when people say, "I don't want to be seen as just my disease," even when you say that, when you say like the disease, whatever is going on in their heads is this sort of catastrophic stigmatizing thing. You can almost see them start to back away, you know, and then they have nothing more to more to ask you or talk about, you know. And then on the other hand, you know, I think that most people with Parkinson's and MS, the reason that there's support groups is because we love nothing more than to talk about the disease and let everyone know exactly what's going on with your medications, with the physical symptoms, the emotional symptoms, the mental systems. But, you know, we learn very quickly that that's boring. But it's also like sort of, okay, because of this, this explains why I may do this or you know, do something like that. So people would say, oh, well, what's happened right there is a result of Parkinson's. We can see how she's dealing with it, so they understand how the disease works at the same time seeing it as separate from the person and not subsuming their identity.
And I suppose that could end up being a really interesting source of material, in a sense, in terms of this narrative project, is just having people talking about Parkinson's. I mean, the various ways in which people have tried to figure out how much should I allow this to sort of dominate my conversation, how much is this going to be of interest to even to people who love me, let alone strangers or coworkers. I mean, it's quite a conundrum, I should think.
Yeah, because I think when you start out, one of the first things, you know, after the initial diagnosis is, yeah, how public do you go with this? So, for example, you start out, of course, by telling your family, then your close friends, and then you have this choice of, do you tell your coworkers? Do you tell your boss? People who have been diagnosed early with young onset, you know, really have to deal with discrimination in the workplace. And so there's sort of what they call like the rhetoric of passing. So if you stay in the closet and you don't announce publicly that you have PD, and then again, how does one do that? There's no sort of precedent for how you would go about, you know, telling people. And so you learn to perform a non-disabled identity. So basically with your meds, with all of the other tricks you learn to pass as normal. And when that becomes, because since Parkinson's is a progressive degenerative disease, you know that in your future there's certain things, you know, you acquire new tricks to pretend to be normal, and then it becomes a choice of, all right, now how do I perform a disabled identity? So you pass as normal, I think, for as long as you can, you know, if nothing else, just to allay the discomfort that other people would feel in interacting with you.
Right. Yeah. But what an exhausting way to live.
Yeah, you're on stage all the time.
We're speaking with Dr. Jenny Nelson, and we're about to speak with Camilo Perez, who is a videographer. Together, they are helping to create the Parkinson's Disease Narrative Project, and they're going to be speaking at the University of Wisconsin Parkside later this morning at 11 o'clock, a public multimedia presentation. Before we bring Camilo into the conversation, Dr. Nelson, just say a word more about exactly what this narrative project is.
The PD Narrative Project was, again, it was funded by an 1804 grant from Ohio University. And we started out by just collecting the stories, the histories of people with Parkinson's. The turn to video came when we began focusing on the details of their everyday lives and their sort of eagerness to show what they can do, the things that they do, and how they cope. So finding the story that they want to tell is part of the challenge of the PD Narrative Project, and then having them collaborate in some way in the telling of their stories, and then participating in the video shoots, and then when we show the sort of like the semi-final product, and we ask them, you know, often like, you know, sort of like, what kind of music do you like that we might, you know, play as the background. But we've got, I think, 12 or 13 short videos now, and the format was deliberate to remain 5 minutes or under, because we want these not to be sort of long, drawn-out things, but just sort of like vignettes that people can go to on our blog, for example, and see the Chuck story, Tom's Woods, and Sarah's film. And so there's a number of people they can meet and see what they're doing and how they're coping with Parkinson's. Mm.
Camila Perez, you have done, in a sense, similar work back in your native land of Colombia, but I understand that that work had nothing specifically to do with Parkinson's disease or people contending with any kind of disease like that at all. And yet there is sort of a relationship between some of that work you did back in Colombia and this work you're doing now on this Parkinson's disease narrative project. Explain what that connection is.
Yeah, I mean, like, the connection is because when we were in Medellin back in 2003, as young students in anthropology, we were, like, also uncomfortable with the stereotypes and the media representations about young people in marginal communities, in the peripheral neighborhoods of my city. And in that sense, like, we start thinking about, like, how we could explore the stories that were there from the voices of the young people. And we didn't know anything about video production, but we thought that it was, I mean, that could be a way to explore the stories and just play around and experiment. So we end up like doing some workshops with different participants, and we collect around 15 stories in 1 year of workshops. And in that sense, like, we start like learning by doing and keep exploring. And what we found, especially like in this context, is that violence has been like really an important and difficult part of their lives and their experiences, but it's not all that happens there. I mean, like, when we talk about Colombia, we often think about violence, drugs, cartels, and all that, but it's not just that. I mean, there's like a lot of life and a lot of joy and a lot of things that are really good, and we need to tell that stories. But we also need to say that by using storytelling and visual storytelling, what we were trying to address was like the less visible effects of that violence. So it's like the silence, the isolation, and the fear. And that's the connection that we found also with disease, is like these same effects that we were addressing in Medellin, Colombia, with this project of visual storytelling, which were like the fear, the isolation, and and the silence, were the same effects that people diagnosed with a chronic illness were suffering. So in that sense, like, we start like thinking about like, all right, how can we adapt this methodology, which was intended to work with violence, to work with people with chronic illness, and to try to bring sort of like a different perspective on how they perceive the illness and how they perceive their agency within their experiences. So to put it like in another word, like how to take something ugly and transform it in something beautiful. Like
something ugly.
By putting like color and something different in there. So in what Jenny was saying about like focusing on little fragments of their experience is also meaningful, because we are not intended to tell the whole story. We are just focusing on little actions that sort of like reinforce that sense of agency, of all that I can do, even with, you know, like this framework of the violence of the illness. And in that sense, like, each video that we have produced focus on one little thing. And we go, like, for example, Jenny's research, or Chuck's truck, or Tom's Woods. So it's like a little part, a little fragment of their story that allow us to explore that activism and that agency of the people.
Mm. So how do you find the people that who end up telling their stories in the Parkinson's Narrative Project? I suppose you find them in all kinds of different ways. I mean, how do you make the connection and issue the invitation for people to be part of this?
Well, I mean, like, that's pretty much, we use a metaphor there. Like, I don't have the Parkinson's visa. So for me, it's really hard to access this community, but Jenny does. So like the thing that Jenny does usually is like going to look for support groups, and she engaged with the support groups a lot. So
right, so I'm the insider with the disease. So there's a, you know, always an immediate connection when you meet someone else with Parkinson's. And I found a support group in Vienna, West Virginia, which is about 40 minutes away from Athens, where there were, it was a, you know, a really lively support group with people, you know, in their 50s and 60s, and you know, there was about maybe 12 of them, I guess. And they were really supportive and pretty much volunteered to tell their stories. One person in particular, Chuck Foster, who's Chuck's Truck, we mention a lot, he sort of started it off, and then when other people saw his video, they were like, they really liked it. And so they began to also step up.
I should think that would make a difference, because I imagine that at least some people that you approach probably can't even conceive of this. I mean, particularly if they're just an ordinary person in a little town in West Virginia and no one's ever wanted to make a video about them for anything, and probably can't even envision what such a thing might be or what possible interest could my story be to someone else. I mean,
that's absolutely exactly the point. And Camille will talk about that.
I mean, like, that's the most challenging part of the project. It's finding the story. Because, like, that what you usually get is, like, I mean, like, I don't have anything to say. I mean, like, my story is so
common. I'm not special.
I'm not interesting.
Yeah, it's like, but, I mean, like, by talking with them, and like, it's like an exercise that we do a lot, is like, just talking and pointing out that there are, like, little things that are meaningful. And even though when they don't think that they're that meaningful, just like that idea of sharing a little part of you so other people can understand what's going on, you know, when you have a chronic illness, it's important. And we start like sort of like exploring little actions. And in that sense, like finding the story become so crucial that some of the people like David have said, like, after going on through this process, I really need to speak out, and nobody's going to, you know, shut me up again. Because, like, I know I have something to say. And that's kind of like the most important part of the project.
Sure. So what is that process like when there's person X and you know that there's a story there, but you don't know, and they don't know what that story is. What is the process by which that story is uncovered? Or do you just start filming? I mean, and does the story sort of reveal itself?
No, it's conversations, and we go along with people walking on their daily lives, and something just pop up, and we start like asking more questions about something that we see that it's maybe interesting. So for example, if you see a guy who does quilts, and you're like, or why do you do quilts? I mean, why quilting is like the way in which you cope with the disease. And even though when they didn't, I mean, David didn't saw that like as a something that different, it was just something that he wanted to do. That was like really important. Like, well, you know, David, that it's something that it's different, and it has like meaning in and importance and significance in its own way. So it's like through going with them in their daily lives and then just pointing out something and then exploring that little detail a little bit further and then thinking about like how we can produce the video with them. Because like that's like the invitation is not that we just come and go there and take the camera out and start shooting. It's more like how we can collaborate.
So it's a partnership in terms of finding the story then.
Yeah, so they don't have like a whole story inside them. You know, everything comes out as most conversations do in sort of like bits and pieces. And so we take the bits and pieces and sort of the Camillo you know, has found some interesting angles, or he edits some pieces together where it's like, well, that looks interesting, and then, you know, more things come out. So it's really sort of a cobbling together of a mosaic in pieces that comes out into just a little tiny narrative of one person, or, you know, each person doing these, you know, different things.
Hmm. We're speaking with Dr. Jenny Nelson, who is a media scholar and founder of the Parkinson's Disease Narrative Project. She is an associate professor at the School of Media Arts and Studies at Ohio University in Athens, Ohio, where Camilo Perez, who's also with us today, is a doctoral student, and together they are creating this Parkinson's Disease Narrative Project. So are these stories intended to be inspirational? Let me try to reforge that question a little bit. I guess what I'm asking is, are you willing, or do you see purpose in sharing those stories of despair that also can be part of the experience of this disease? That is, do you intend this narrative project to be really not about that at all, and more about being a beacon of hope for somebody with Parkinson's by seeing the way in which people can positively live with this disease? And I'm trying to forge this in a way that doesn't sound like I think it should be one or the other, but the fact is that if you intend this project to be, in a sense, as positive and uplifting as possible, that's a very important purpose, but it's also not the entire scope of what this disease means in the lives of people. Do you understand the question? I hope it's making sense.
No, it's actually a really, really good question. And one of those two poles of inspiration and despair, we sort of intentionally avoided, because in our research, when we would look at other videos, they would be like this, like, I've got this disease and I can beat it, and if I eat right and I exercise and da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, I can come out on top, I can, like, live, and, you know, da-da-da-da. And we really wanted to stay away from that, and we really wanted to stay away from then the, you know, the despair and the music and this you know, and even though both of those are true.
Right.
But ours sort of, you know, of course we want people to find hope in sharing stories with other people. And I'm trying to just think of the videos. I mean, they sort of end with, you know, like, what's your story? So sort of here's one, and you must have something to share. So it's an invitation to participate in, in collaboration. So, like I said, we're not like going on one end or the other, but just trying to, you know, Camilo.
Yeah, and in that sense, like that's the idea of sort of like community building in there, like the dialogue that is being sort of like happening is that by doing each video and posing there like the invitation to share another story and another story, what has been constructed is like a collective illness experience.
Mm.
And in that sense, it's like how we can also share this and escalate that to other spheres and other spaces.
Mm. So all of these stories are from people, in a sense, kind of in your own backyard, right? I mean, they're all pretty much drawn from this one single support group. That being said, is this a project you hope can kind of leap to another level in terms of stories being gathered from people in all kinds of different places, or would that alter the project to have it sort of grow to that kind of scale?
Well, actually, that's the direction that the project has taken, actually. In places like here in Kenosha, the other places we've been, University of Texas, El Paso, and Oklahoma University, we've met a number of people through our presentations who have Parkinson's disease or know people who do. And we've gotten into contact actually over Facebook with a person who has already been doing visual narratives and posting them on Facebook, and we've gotten in touch with him and had several discussions about doing a collaborative work. And so, yeah, so we're connecting with people outside of the area now who are actually a little more interested in doing the actual video work and, you know, just sort of doing it themselves. So, yeah, we definitely want to reach out and find more people who would like to participate in the project.
So when you put one of these together with a certain person, what kind of span of time are we talking about in terms of where you are with them? I mean, is it for many, many days and hours upon hours? Only after that does the story start to emerge, or is it a little simpler process than that? I mean, or maybe does it vary dramatically from person to person? Are there some instances in which the story makes itself very apparent very quickly, and others where you shoot a lot of footage before anything interesting finally appears?
Yeah, it's like a really personalized process, because each time, depending on the interaction we have, on the situation of each person, it can be one day, it can be months. So like, for example, Jenny's radar, I mean, like the very first video, it was shot in one afternoon, right? Mm. And it was edited in like, you know, weekend.
Right, we were just playing with it. My husband had just given me an action cam for Christmas. Mm. So I brought it to school. Camillo had like his camera. We just sort of went outside and started shooting these sort of, it's like walk up the alley, walk down the alley, do this, and playing with the camera because didn't know how it worked. And we had the footage, and 2 days later, Camillo had it edited. And
Jenny's story.
Jenny's radar, right.
And with other cases, it takes longer. So, for example, Sarah's film was like a process in which we engaged for weeks and like to try to find the story. And in that sense, like it took a lot of conversations and then a lot of sessions to shoot also, and then a lot of sessions to edit with them. So like it depends. But like the idea is, it's like to go with the rhythm of each person. Mm. And 'cause like that idea of the invitation is always there to collaborate. So we don't have any rush, which is just like, let's go in this journey together and find your story. Hmm.
Professor Nelson, what has this meant for you? First, I gotta mention too, I'm a little surprised in a sense that we've talked almost not at all about your own Parkinson's disease. I mean, we've mentioned that you were diagnosed in 2010, but I haven't asked you a single question about, you know, for instance, how your life has changed since that diagnosis and the kind of things with which you're contending. And mm-hmm. we can maybe take a moment or two to talk about that if you like. But I really am specifically interested or curious in what this has meant for you, that is, this Parkinson's disease narrative project. What it has meant for you in coming to terms with this yourself? What kind of a difference has it made for you that this project exists and that you are pouring so much of your heart and soul into it?
Mm-hmm. Well, it lets me talk about myself all the time.
Lucky you.
You know, so in a different context. It does two things, and I think this is something that every person with a chronic illness faces. It allows you to focus on something in a sense other than your own disease. Hmm. So whether I'm doing sort of like my pine cone art and I can and focus, because one of the less talked about symptoms of Parkinson's is something they call executive dysfunction. Which the analogy would be, if you're the flight controller at an airport, there are 25 planes circling, and you can't decide which one to land. So faced with all these sorts of options, you just become sort of addled and confused, and then all the planes crash and burn. And so, you know, being able to focus, and in my case, being able to focus on other people with Parkinson's, you know, allows me to do a lot of comparison in terms of, you know, where I'm going. When I was first diagnosed and I met people who were at later stages of the disease, it was terrifying. I didn't want to have anything to do with that. Mm. I would see somebody and I would hide behind a post and watch them in horror. Mm. Thinking, you know, that's going to be me.
That's my future.
And I didn't want to have anything to do with that. Mm. And so by sort of forcing myself to go into these support groups and to not only stare at people who have more advanced symptoms, but then to become friends with them has sort of lessened the horror story. But again, I think that the focus on something that is so close to me allows me to understand it better. And I feel, you know, that there's some expertise I have in that. But it's the same thing. By focusing on Parkinson's, I sort of transcend it at the same time. And it's, again, by focusing on other people's experiences, allows me a pretty shape-shifting, moment in doing that. Mm. But, yeah, so I feel as engaged as a scholar and as a creative person in my field of study, media arts and studies, as I've ever been in my life. Mm. So it's been a really, really happy collaboration with Camillo.
The small little video of your story, which I have viewed and found really, really interesting, I especially appreciated the very concise, cogent summary you gave of what Parkinson's is, of what's going wrong in the body when someone has Parkinson's. And the parallel you drew was to a car, and when that car doesn't have oil anymore. Can you just share that? I thought that was just a really marvelous way of thinking about what happens to the body when it is suffering from Parkinson's.
Right. So as a neurological disease, there's the loss of dopamine, and that results in the lack of motor control from the brain to the body. And so in the substantia nigra of the brain, that's where all the dopamine lies. And as you said, it's like running out of oil in the car, and you can, you know, the car starts to shake and to shudder, and then everything sort of comes to a stop. So,
why is it that we see such a difference between, I mean, as you said, certain people in which there are very, very visible symptoms, and then others? I mean, as I meet you today, I would never guess that there was anything like Parkinson's going on inside your body. Is it because it's so early in the progression of the disease for you, or does Parkinson's really, in a sense, behave dramatically differently from patient to patient?
Well, there is the it is often called, you know, an individual disease, but it's testing the limits of how medications can control the visible symptoms. So you can't see any of the symptoms for me right now because I know that I have I've just taken my medication, and so I know exactly how long that lasts and when I'm due for another medication. I also know that in the past week, my medications have been increased. So I know that I'm at stage two now instead of stage one. And what happens is that the Sinemet, which is an interesting drug, because the Sine means brain and the Met means basically without vomiting.
Oh. Lovely.
So it's a drug that, when it was first introduced, made everyone extremely ill, and so they added on another component, and so that made, you know, you could swallow it without puking it back up, which was, you know, always very nice. But it also, you know, points out like this sort of like the this game with meds that we all play, and that increasingly, and a couple of our videos deal with people who have reached that level of medical toxicity, where much of what they do is not the result of Parkinson's, but a result of the side effects of the medications. And so they're left in a dilemma of like, so I should stop taking this medicine or have it and then sort of go back to a lot of tremors, a lot of rigidity to less movement, or do I keep taking the drug to control my body at the same time I'm having hallucinations or having a gambling addiction?
Wow.
So there is a point in the road where either medical science improves or something where that the thing that's helping you at one point will become the thing that becomes as much of a problem as the Parkinson's itself.
Mm. Boy, so, and there's some tough choices then that people end up facing. I mean, I should think that gets really complicated.
Yeah, and then there's like the next step, which two of the people who we did videos about have turned to, which is deep brain stimulation surgery, where they drill holes in your head and hook you up to a monitor, so it's a sort of like a pacemaker in your heart.
Hmm.
And that's like the new thing that's been going on for a number of years. Doctors, neurologists will move into an area, get a lot of people, a lot of patients together, have them go through the surgery, and then in 2 years they leave. Hmm. So there's the medications, the pharmaceutical industry, which may be more interested in making more meds for more people rather than finding a cure, because then they might be out of business. So there's all sorts of interesting stories with people with Parkinson's. Do they have medical insurance? Can they afford the medications? I didn't know that one of the medications I was on, which helped tremendously with my symptoms, for a person without insurance would cost $800 a month.
Oh, wow.
Who knew?
Wow. Right? Well, thanks to the Narrative Project, now a lot of us know a lot more than we did. In fact, I should think it's been an extraordinary learning experience for you, Camillo, having not ever had any involvement in a film project specifically tied to a disease like Parkinson's. I can't even imagine how much you have learned, just you yourself personally, in being part of this.
Yeah, that's true. It has been like a really interesting and emotional experience, and I'm really grateful like for this and to meet Jenny, because like we have been working really good like these 2 years, and I don't know. I mean, let's see what happens next, right? I mean, like we are just like working on this and thinking about like what will be the next step.
Hmm.
One of the great things about Camillo is that he communicates with people very well. And one of the ways that he does this, especially when he's shooting, is that he manages to disappear behind the camera.
Mm.
You know, if you see the video Chuck's truck, Camillo had just met Chuck, and Chuck invited him to go for a ride. And Camillo, without any hesitation, jumped into the cab of the truck and just did this really great angle. And Chuck was willing to tell his story. So Camillo has, you know, this energy of people will talk to him under, you know, any circumstances. So there's a real gift there as well.
So if people want to watch the films that have already been created, where do they go?
We have a blog called the PD Narrative Project, blogspot.com. And there we've got a number of different stories. While we were working on some of the productions, there's a video channel where all 12 videos are stored, so you can watch them in any order and make comments. If you'd like to contribute anything, we'd be happy to participate.
Hmm. And we want to remind everyone that the two of you are making a multimedia presentation later this morning, 11 o'clock at UW Parkside, Molinaro 105. The public is welcome to attend. Very quickly, tell our listeners also about the Pine Cones for Parkinson's that you are involved in.
Pine Cones for Parkinson's is an art project that I've been involved with 1 year when the Buckeyes didn't go very well in Athens. So I began gathering pine cones and also these things from the sweet gum tree, which are the these spiky seed balls that fall from trees, and they're incredibly annoying. There's thousands of them all over the street in people's yards. They hate them. But they serve a very useful purpose in propagating. So I took this ugly little creature and began spray painting and glittering and putting ribbons and beads on them, and have had several installations in some cafes in town,